Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is on assignment. On the NewsHour tonight, the urgent effort by the U.S. and European allies to arm Ukraine ahead of an expected Russian offensive. Anti-abortion activists march in Washington, D.C., celebrating the overturning of Roe v. Wade while setting their sights on further restrictions.
Our movement is about doing one thing, and that's ending the violence of abortion.
And the Republican leading one of the most influential congressional committees discusses his plans to investigate the Biden White House. Good evening. It's good to be with you. Ukraine tonight is still battling through a winter of war and still appealing for tanks to help turn the tide against the Russians. The U.S. and dozens of other countries wrestled with that question for more than 5 hours today at a meeting in Germany. In the end, there was no agreement on providing tanks. They did agree to send hundreds of other armored vehicles, but Ukraine's leaders said they'll keep pressing for the tanks. In Peru, the capital city, Lima, braced for more protests today after thousands of demonstrators clashed with police overnight. Crowds demanded the ouster of the country's new president and appealed for new elections. Police fired tear gas to disperse the protesters. Dozens of people have died in the unrest since President Pedro Castillo was removed from office and jailed last month. The Church of England has formally apologized for its treatment of LGBTQ people and what it calls a hostile and homophobic response. At the same time, Anglican bishops said a ban on same-sex weddings in churches will stay in force. The announcements followed 5 years of internal debate and came at a news conference in London.
I also know that saying sorry doesn't cut it for some people. It sounds hollow. It's all very well you saying sorry. The church still isn't giving us what we want. That is how some people are responding. And I want to say, yeah, I do get that, but it doesn't mean the sorry isn't still heartfelt.
The bishops are proposing that the church allow services for same-sex couples that include blessings after they've had a civil wedding. The wave of job cuts sweeping the tech industry have now hit Google. The company said today it's laying off 12,000 workers, 6% of its total workforce, as the pandemic-era boom fades. So far this month, tech firms, to include Microsoft, Amazon, and others, have cut nearly 50,000 jobs. New numbers also give fresh evidence of a slump in the U.S. housing industry. The National Association of Realtors reports sales of existing homes dropped nearly 18% last year from a year earlier. That made 2022 the slowest year for the U.S. housing market in nearly a decade. The slowdown came as mortgage interest rates more than doubled during the year. Elon Musk began testifying in San Francisco today in a federal class action suit over tweets about Tesla. The billionaire claimed in 2018 that he had the financing to take his electric auto company private, but the deal never happened. Investors say they suffered losses because Musk deceived them about the funding. On the stand, Musk defended his tweets, but acknowledged they could not provide full information by their very nature. And on Wall Street, stocks ended the week with a rally led by tech shares. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 331 points, or 1%, to close at 33,375. The NASDAQ jumped 288 points, nearly 2.7%, and the S&P 500 was up almost 2%. And still to come on the NewsHour, COVID casts a shadow over the Chinese New Year as billions of people travel to celebrate with family. Cities look to free public busing to counteract inequity. And David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the latest political headlines.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Ukraine will soon receive an unprecedented amount of new weapons systems thanks to a deal made by a group of some 50 nations today. But the weapons do not include the one item that Ukraine calls its priority, Western tanks. Nick Schifrin reports.
For Ukraine's Western military support, today was the best of times and the worst of times. For the first time, the U.S. will send Stryker armored personnel carriers. That's in addition to hundreds more Bradley fighting vehicles and European armored vehicles designed to provide Ukraine with the fundamental building blocks for how modern armies fight. It's a major upgrade to Ukraine's mostly Soviet-era armor to help Kyiv try and re-seize occupied territory. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
This is a very, very capable package. And they, you know, if employed properly, it will enable them to be successful.
But Ukraine did not get the item it says it most needs, Western tanks. There are 2,000 German Leopard 2 tanks across Europe. Germany today resisted calls to send its own tanks or allow other countries to re-export their Leopard tanks to Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
And I can thank you hundreds of times, and it will be absolutely just and fair, given all that we have already done. But hundreds of thank you are not hundreds of thanks.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki.
The Germans are defending themselves against this like a devil protects himself against holy water.
The U.S. and Europe are upgrading Soviet-era tanks. But the U.S., too, has refused to send its own M1 Abrams tanks. U.S. officials say its jet engine and jet fuel make it unsustainable. Germany's government says they'll only approve tanks as part of what they call a transatlantic lockstep decision.
We don't fear anything. We have just responsibility for our population in Germany and in Europe. And we have to balance all the pros and cons before we decide things like that.
There's a reason you have tanks. The tank can absorb hits from almost anything.
Retired General Ben Hodges is the former commander of the U.S. Army in Europe.
The gun it has, the commander's station, the ability to find targets, it's unsurpassed. So whether it's an Abrams or Leopard, that kind of capability would be needed as part of the spearhead.
When the U.S. Army fights, it uses what it calls combined arms, infantry, artillery, but also tanks that the U.S. sells all over the world.
U.S. officials say that M1 Abrams tanks are too difficult for Ukraine to maintain. The Abrams has a jet engine, requires a jet fuel. What's your response to that?
I think these are a series of statements that are not terribly inaccurate, but it's sort of a condescending attitude. And I would say, let the Ukrainians figure it out. They can figure out how to do the fuel. We do it. Egyptians do it. Saudis do it.
It will enable the Ukrainians to be successful.
The U.S. says its long-term goal is to give Ukraine the strongest possible position at the negotiating table. It doesn't use the word victory.
The problem is the secretary never says what success is. And to me, this has been the missing thing all along. Instead of saying we want to help Ukraine win, we talk around that a little bit. If we don't get that part right here, this war will go on a lot longer than it could.
On German tanks, the National Security Council spokesman said today the U.S. was not, quote, arm-twisting Germany, but working inside the coalition to provide Ukraine what it needs. For more on all this, we turn to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Colin Call, who joins us from the Pentagon. Colin Call, welcome back to the NewsHour. As we heard from the Secretary of Defense earlier and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the goal of the weapons packages that the U.S. and allies have announced in the last day are to conduct what the U.S. calls combined arms in order for Ukraine to liberate occupied territory. And yet a key component of combined arms is the tank. So are you tying one of Ukraine's arms behind its back by not providing those Western tanks?
Thanks, Nick. Thanks for having me on. Look, I think the main message coming out of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, which was this meeting of more than four dozen countries at Ramstein Air Base, was one of unity and solidarity in support of Ukraine. You know, as the lead-in noted, we announced a package in the last 24 hours of $2.5 billion of additional assistance. That brings the total to close to $27 billion since Russia's invasion last February. All told, allies and partners have provided enough armor for several mechanized brigades. So as Secretary of Defense Austin made clear, we do believe that we are providing Ukraine the capabilities in combination with the training to allow them to change the dynamic on the battlefield and really move away from the kind of trench-style warfare that we're seeing in places like Bakhmut and Soledar to, being better able to combine fire and maneuver.
Brigades, of course, an average of about 3,500 troops each, kind of the building blocks for how the U.S. thinks about how to fight. But didn't we see at the beginning of the war what happens when you don't conduct combined arms? The Russians, after all, did it piecemeal, and the Ukrainians picked them apart. So is there still the ability for Ukraine to conduct what the U.S. calls combined arms without these Western tanks at once?
I have no doubt that the Ukrainians can engage in combined arms warfare. But it's not just about stuff. It's about the training, the collective training in particular. We're working alongside Ukrainian forces to precisely train them on the types of combined arms maneuver warfare that you referenced. And I'll just say on the tanks issue, you know, we saw from the German defense minister today that they're still engaged in ongoing deliberations on the Leopards. We know that there are more than a dozen countries that also have Leopard tanks, and they're having conversations with Germany. So I think we just have to let this process play out.
When it comes to U.S. M1 Abrams tanks, you heard retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, former commander of U.S. Army Europe, call the argument that the Abrams is too difficult to maintain because of its jet engine and jet fuel, quote, condescending, and the Ukrainians can figure out how to keep the M1 Abrams going. Why do you think they can't?
Well, I don't think the argument is that they can't. The question is, can you deliver the capability on a relevant time frame and at a level that's sustainable over time? And the challenge with the Abrams is it's expensive, it's difficult to train on, it is very difficult to sustain, it has a huge complicated turbine engine that requires jet fuel. And frankly, if we're looking at delivering the Ukrainians a capability they can use in the next couple of months to try to change the dynamic on the battlefield, our assessment is just that the Abrams is not the right capability at this time.
Another way to change the dynamic on the battlefield would, of course, be to threaten Crimea, which Russia has occupied since 2014. Is it a U.S. goal to enable Ukraine to threaten Russia's hold on Crimea?
Crimea, legally and in the eyes of most of the world, Vladimir Putin notwithstanding, is Ukraine. So it is occupied Ukraine, and if the Ukrainians decide to conduct operations in Crimea, that is their decision.
The British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly was in Washington, D.C. this past week, and he said this: if we want to bring this to a successful conclusion, we should look to bring it to a conclusion quickly. The conclusion has to be Ukrainian victory. That is not a word that the United States uses. Why not?
Well, because it's not our word to choose. The Ukrainians will be the ones who define what the parameters of success are in their campaign. I will say this. It has been our strategic objective to enable the Ukrainians to achieve success as they define it, and also to ensure that the conflict is a strategic failure for Vladimir Putin and Russia. And in that, the war to date has been a huge failure for Russia. Ukraine endures as an independent, sovereign, democratic country. Russia wanted to end that. NATO is stronger, it's not weaker. The world is more united, not more divided, and Russia is weaker, not stronger. So along every metric that Vladimir Putin set out at the beginning of this war, he has failed, and I expect he will continue to do so.
Does that mean you're trying to give Ukraine enough weapons to make sure that Russia doesn't win, but not enough weapons for Ukraine to achieve victory?
We are providing Ukraine the capability they need to re-seize the territory that Russia occupied from them. The exact parameters of Ukrainian success or victory is something that the government in Kyiv will define.
Colin Call, finally, while I have you, you were then Vice President Biden's national security advisor at the end of the Obama administration in January 2017. What were the vice president and yours practices when it comes to handling classified documents, which, of course, is in the news? And going forward, will you cooperate with any kind of special counsel or congressional request for an investigation?
Look, I know there's a lot of interest in this topic. I can't really comment on it given the ongoing DOJ investigation. But like the rest of the administration, I stand ready to cooperate. And I know that officials at the White House and other senior officials have made that clear. We'll do everything we need to do to cooperate with the Department of Justice.
Colin Call, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anti-abortion activists gathered on the National Mall today for the annual March for Life. It was the first time the march has been held since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, ending the constitutional right to an abortion. In a report co-produced with the PBS NewsHour, Kaiser Health News correspondent Sarah Varney spoke with those gathered in Washington about what this moment means for them.
Today in the nation's capital, anti-abortion activists celebrated an achievement decades in the making.
This year is different. We have overturned Roe v. Wade with the Mississippi Dobbs case. We have done that.
But movement leaders and grassroots activists gathered here from around the country say there's still work left to do. Christine Miller is from Texas, where abortion is illegal.
We've got to take this fight more to people and to people's hearts. And it's more of letting people understand that we love each baby, we love each woman, and we want to help them just to show them that through all the difficulties of life, we're here to help them.
So would you like to see a federal ban on abortion in the U.S.?
Absolutely. We'd like to see a federal ban, yes.
Lawyer Nellie Gray held the first march after the Supreme Court issued its 7-2 decision in Roe v. Wade.
The reason I'm here is because babies are being killed in our hospitals and clinics. I can't tolerate it. America can't tolerate it.
Since then, church groups and conservative Christian organizations have fueled the movement. For many, religious beliefs inspired them to get involved. Trinity Wicker is a senior at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. She's part of a group of students who traveled here from Louisiana, where women are not allowed to terminate a pregnancy, even in cases of rape or incest. Wicker has spent this week in Washington, D.C., gearing up for today's march. The NewsHour caught up with Wicker yesterday on the National Mall.
As a young person, help us understand why you're invested in this movement.
Well, I believe that God is the creator of life and no human should be able to dictate whether someone should or should not live or have a chance at living.
In a movement that is largely white, Wicker says she wants to reach other black women.
Just let them know that, you know, it's not the right way, it's not the right decision. And I think once we inform them more about that, my peers as well, I think that the movement can go a long way.
For decades, the March for Life ended at the U.S. Supreme Court, but this year it will pass by the U.S. Capitol and end between the Capitol and the court, signaling a shift in the movement's focus to lawmakers.
We are not yet done.
Jeannie Mancini runs March for Life, which organized today's event.
Where do you want to take the movement next?
Well, to begin with, it's a moment to celebrate for the pro-life movement that Roe was overturned. So just to stop and to take a step back and to think about all the things that led to this moment. So that's very important for today.
Since the Supreme Court overturned Roe, at least 13 states have banned abortions in all or nearly all cases, and a number of other states restrict abortion care. Across the country, abortion supporters are challenging abortion bans in state courts. There's active litigation in 14 states. 6 months after the court's decision, the effect on those seeking abortion continues to make headlines. Women having miscarriages turned away from emergency rooms. And where abortion remains legal, clinics are overwhelmed with patients from other states. Still, 62% of Americans think abortion should be legal in all or most cases, according to a survey conducted last year by the Pew Research Center.
Well, the fight is not over, certainly. There's still crisis unplanned pregnancies.
Kristen Hawkins is president of Students for Life, with more than 1,200 student groups around the country.
Our movement is about doing one thing, and that's ending the violence of abortion. So when we're writing laws, we're advocating for the passage of laws, that's what our intended effect is, and that's our goal.
And is the goal, too, to establish fetal rights nationally?
Absolutely. I mean, the movement has always been clear that we, you know, philosophically, there is no difference. Morally, there is no difference between the fetus, the embryo, the zygote, whatever you want to call the child in the womb, to the person you are today. And both have an equal right to life. We have
this in- Abortion pills, an FDA-approved two-pill regimen that safely stops a pregnancy and induces a miscarriage, are used in over half of pregnancy terminations in the U.S. The pills are illegal in states like Texas, and Hawkins wants elected officials to crack down.
So would the idea be that a state like Texas would somehow prevent the medication abortion pills from coming into the state?
Absolutely. We've been meeting with state attorneys generals about this, talking about how state officials, how state office holders can hold hold these companies accountable to stop the distribution of these dangerous drugs in their states.
Today marks a turning point for a movement that has had a singular focus for decades. But that focus is fracturing into competing priorities as the practical implications of criminalizing abortion take hold. For the PBS NewsHour and Kaiser Health News, I'm Sarah Varney in Washington.
The House Oversight Committee under new Republican leadership has announced its first hearing set for next month on mismanagement of pandemic relief funding. The committee's new chairman, Kentucky Republican James Comer, says his passion is tackling waste, fraud, and abuse of taxpayer dollars in the federal government. The panel's other priorities include investigating the Biden administration's immigration policies, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and the business dealings of Biden family members. I spoke with Congressman Comer earlier today, starting with the issue currently in the Oversight Committee's crosshairs, the discovery of classified documents from President Biden's time as vice president. House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer, welcome to the NewsHour.
Thanks for having me.
Your committee is zeroing in on the classified documents discovered at President Biden's private residence and his private office. What questions do you want answered?
We'd like to know who had access to those documents, how those documents ended up in multiple locations, and who all was responsible for notifying the National Archives that these documents were in the possession of Joe Biden, and why did it take so long for us to learn that these documents had been recovered? We don't believe that we would ever know were it not for investigative reporting by CBS. So we have a lot of questions about the documents, in addition to the fact that we'd like to know what type of documents were in possession of President Biden.
The president initially said that he was surprised to learn about the discovery of these documents. Do you believe him?
Yeah, I'm sure that should be of more concern to the American people, that he didn't know he had them, because it's hard for me to believe that when they were moving Joe Biden out of the vice president's office, that they said, okay, we're going to take one set of documents to the Biden Center for Diplomacy, and we're going to set the other box of documents in the garage at the president's house in Delaware. You would believe that there's a possibility that somebody at some point moved the documents from one location to another. So that's why we need to know who all was in the proximity of the classified documents, and who in fact first discovered the documents, and what that process was, and why didn't the White House immediately tell the American people that they had made a mistake and had improperly stored classified documents, considering the fact that the president made a very big deal out of it when President Trump did the same thing.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you have said that your biggest concern isn't the classified documents, but how there's such a discrepancy in how former President Trump was treated. How can the American people view your investigation as credible when you openly admit that you're not as concerned about the underlying issue?
The underlying issue is not being understood by the national media. The underlying issue is we're conducting a very thorough and substantive investigation of the Biden family for influence peddling. There's no question the Bidens have received millions of dollars from our adversaries in China and Russia, as well as from some shady characters in Ukraine. Now, why are they sending so much money to the Bidens? Obviously, they want a return on their investment. So when we learn that there are documents that have been strewed all over the place, and that people like Hunter Biden and the president's two brothers had access to those documents, and they're under investigation for influence peddling, then that's a concern, because we wonder whether or not this administration's compromised because of the millions of dollars the Biden family's received from our adversaries around the world.
You're connecting a lot of dots there. What evidence do you have to back up those assertions?
It's not hard to connect the dots here, that there's been a lot of money wired into various Biden interests from our adversaries around the world, and we're concerned that they're doing this not out of charity, but because they want to get something in return. When we find out that there are documents that have been mishandled at the Biden residence where the president's brothers and son spend a lot of time, then we're concerned.
Will you subpoena White House officials or the president himself as part of this investigation?
It's very complicated to subpoena a sitting president of the United States, so the odds of that happening are slim to none. We'll have questions at the end of our investigation, I'm sure, for the president before we issue a report to give him an opportunity to challenge any of the assumptions from our final investigation, because we want to be fair and balanced here. So the president will have an opportunity to defend himself. I don't think it'll be under subpoena or under oath in front of the House Oversight Committee.
Have congressional subpoenas been undermined by the fact that House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and at least a couple of members of the House Oversight Committee, Republican members, have defied subpoenas from the January 6th committee looking into the attack on the U.S. Capitol?
I think the subpoenas have been undermined by the fact that the Democrats issued too many. I mean, the Democrats were sending subpoenas out to Trump officials like junk mail. And the more subpoenas you issue, the less value they have. And I think that, you know, the whole credibility of congressional oversight has been undermined because of people like Adam Schiff and because of high-profile investigations from both parties in the past that never really amounted to anything. So I recognize the fact that congressional investigations don't have the credibility that they should. And it's going to be my job to try to have a credible investigation based on facts that is fair and balanced. And in the end, hopefully there'll be things accomplished.
Taking your point about credibility, your committee includes a number of Republican hardliners who have denied the election results of 2020, who have openly floated conspiracy theories. At least two of them have associated with white supremacists. Why should any member of Congress with that track record have a role on your committee, a key committee that has the responsibility of ensuring accountability across the entire federal government?
Both sides of the aisle on the Oversight Committee have what you would call firebrands. Remember, they have the majority of the squad over there. You have Tlaib, who has said anti-Semitic statements. You have Ocasio-Cortez and Presley and Bush, who have said things that I would consider anti-American. So, you know, both sides of the aisle have members of Congress that aren't in the mainstream, so to speak. But I'm confident that the people on my committee are there for the right reasons. They're duly elected. They wanted to be on the Oversight Committee. They fought hard to get on the Oversight Committee. This was the committee that was in more demand than any committee in the House of Representatives. So I'm honored to have the people that the steering committee chose to put on my committee. I will say this, anything that ends up on Oversight Committee stationery is going to be factual. We'll look into a lot of things. I'm sure there's going to be things that people on both sides of the aisle say that may or not be 100% in line with reality sometimes. But at the end of the day, when we publish a report and when our work is done with respect to certain investigation, then I think you're going to see that 100% of what's going to be in that report is going to be factual and verifiable.
House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer, sir, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Since the abrupt dismantling of the Chinese government's zero COVID policy, many people have been anxious about China opening up to the rest of the world and the wave of infections that have swept through the country. But as special correspondent Richard Kimber reports, most are brushing risks and fears aside to celebrate the most important festival on the Chinese calendar, the Lunar New Year.
It's just days to go before the start of the spring festival. In Beijing, the holiday rush has already begun. This is the first time mass travel without COVID restrictions has been allowed in nearly 3 years. For many of the capital's migrant workers who come to make a better living for their families, it's an emotional return home to be with their loved ones. Qinze Guang from Changchun in northeastern China hasn't been back in 5 years.
Finally, I'm going back home. Before, I was quite busy in Beijing, and in the past 3 years, I couldn't go back because of the epidemic.
China's Ministry of Transport says it expects travel to double compared to a year ago, to more than 2 billion trips over the holiday period. It would mark a recovery to 70% of pre-pandemic levels. Scenes at the railway station are in stark contrast with how it looked before China abandoned its strict zero-COVID approach following widespread anger over pandemic curbs. Gone are the security personnel dressed in hazmat suits that patrolled transport hubs, and QR health code checkpoints where people had to verify their health status before entering are nowhere to be seen either.
Of course it's now more convenient. It's easy coming in and out. I can go wherever I want.
But now the virus has been let loose, some aren't taking chances. One man we spoke to, called Hua, said even though he's returning home, he won't be visiting friends or relatives.
The epidemic hasn't ended. I wear this to protect myself as well as others.
London-based health analytics firm Airfinity forecasts that China could see as many as 36,000 deaths a day over the spring festival holidays. Over the past 2 months, COVID-19 has ripped through the country, crowding out hospitals and filling crematoriums like this one. Officially, about 60,000 people have died of COVID-19 since early December. That's according to China's National Health Commission. Medical experts say the true figure could be 10 times that. But it's hard to say exactly where the death toll stands. The World Health Organization has accused China of underestimating the severity of its outbreak. Earlier this month, it also said a lack of data from the country was making it difficult to help manage the risks. Mike Ryan is executive director of the WHO.
We do want and are working ever closer with our colleagues in China to try and understand better the transmission dynamics. But we still do not have adequate information to make a full comprehensive risk assessment, and therefore we will continue to try to encourage access to that data.
Medical experts have also warned that the rapid spread of the virus now might make the emergence of mutations more likely. Several countries, including the US, have imposed travel restrictions on arrivals from China. But at the same time, many other places are welcoming the return of Chinese tourists. Among them, Hong Kong. It's a special administrative region of China. Even it had been largely cut off from the mainland until borders fully reopened this month.
The high-speed rail line behind me that connects the Chinese mainland to Hong Kong has been closed throughout the pandemic. Now it's reopening, it's expected to see a surge in the number of Chinese tourists coming across the border. And just to give you an idea of how important that is for the Hong Kong economy, before the COVID-19 pandemic, more than two-thirds of the 56 million arrivals into Hong Kong from overseas came from across the border.
Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, the city's fallen into a deep recession. Many people are praying a rebound in retail and tourism will help lift the economy. But economists remain pessimistic and say a meaningful recovery could take much longer. Its fate is tied closely to the mainland's uncertain outlook. China's surveyed unemployment rate for December likely stood above the government's targeted ceiling of 5.5%. Dan Wang is chief economist with Hang Seng Bank.
With this kind of high unemployment rate, people's expectation for future growth prospect is quite low. And with that, that means even if we see some of the rebound for the tourist sites and big cities, the general recovery will not really be there. We really have to wait until 2024 before we see the general recovery.
But as the country marks its first spring festival free from COVID restrictions, many people are simply celebrating the moment and hoping to put the past few tough years behind them. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Richard Kimber in Hong Kong.
The drive for free public busing is speeding up, at least in some places. William Brangham has more.
There are a number of cities that seem to be moving towards offering 100% free service on public buses. In fact, that's expected to start here in Washington, D.C. later this year. Casey Kuhn, who is one of our digital video producers, has been looking into that and filed this report for our website.
Taking the bus in Washington, D.C. is about to get a lot more affordable.
Dozens of cities in America offer free bus rides in some capacity, but a new move by Washington, D.C. could make it the largest city in America to offer free bus rides, affecting hundreds of thousands of riders who wait at these stops every day.
Riders like Wyan.
I think it's a great thing, especially for graduate students like me.
He's a physicist PhD candidate who studies biomass at Georgetown University. And he says taking public transit is a must.
We don't have a lot of money, and so transportation is always a big problem. So this is a small burden that is lifted in a way.
The D.C. City Council voted unanimously in early December to offer free bus rides for anyone getting on a bus in the district, resident or otherwise, and to extend a dozen popular bus routes to include overnight service. A majority of D.C. residents who ride the bus make less than $50,000 a year, according to the City Council. For riders like Emmanuel, who commutes to work via bus, it's more than a convenience, it's a help financially.
It's going to be like $200. Everyone is going to save around every month, so it's good.
The change will cost the city an expected $42 million the first year. And the move comes as part of a growing push to make public transportation free across the country. Other cities like Alexandria, Virginia, and Kansas City, Missouri, have already made their bus rides free. The goal is to create a more equitable public transportation that will benefit the people who don't have any other option. Isabel, who takes the bus on occasion, agrees.
I heard when they were in talks about that it was proposed, but I thought there was no way it was going to go through. And then when a day or two later I saw that it was passed, I was very excited. I think it's going to make it more accessible to everyone, and especially it'll benefit those who need it most.
Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has also fought for free transit. The state of Massachusetts tried out free regional bus fares across the board during the holiday season only, and the city has made fares free on several widely used Boston City routes, pushing back against critics who say the lost revenue does not make up for the gain in ridership. The D.C. proposal cleared its last council vote and is now sitting on the D.C. mayor's desk. If it moves forward, free bus fares would begin in July. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Casey Kuhn.
So as Casey reported, there are still a number of questions for cities who are considering doing something similar. So to get a wider view of what's happening, we're joined by Yona Freemark, who studies this field for the Urban Institute. Yona, thank you so much for being here. As we heard in Casey's report, Washington, D.C. is making this move. Can you give us a little sense, what is it that cities do want to do this? What's the rationale for this?
There are a few key reasons. Number one, during the pandemic, we saw a lot of cities want to improve service for their customers in a way that reduced the contact with drivers. So they said, fine, board at the back of the bus, don't pay a fare. And with that, I think a lot of cities got the idea and got the knowledge that it was possible to make buses free without too much of an inconvenience. At the same time, a lot of cities around the country are trying to increase the equity of service and trying to make sure that public transportation is something that's useful for everyone.
As we heard in this report, a lot of DC riders on the buses are people who don't make a lot of money, and so this could be a real savings for them. But she also reported that this is going to cost DC something like $42 million. Are there other benefits that the city could get for that cost?
Well, the biggest benefit is going to go directly into the pocketbooks and the wallets of people who are riding the bus. And that's mostly going to be people who live in the city of Washington, but also some people from the suburbs. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the city is going to benefit in terms of, you know, increased revenues, but it could benefit in terms of higher quality of life for the residents who live here.
So are there examples of cities that have tried this where those goals have actually been met? Meaning, does this actually work?
So most of the research tells us that when cities make public transportation free, ridership does go up. And we've actually seen that to be the case in Richmond, Virginia, where ridership on their transit system has increased substantially since the buses were made free. That said, there's not much evidence that making buses free is going to get people out of their cars. Those people are likely to remain in their cars even if buses are free.
I see. So if ridership goes up, is it your sense that public transit systems around the country that might be considering this can handle that increased ridership? Does their infrastructure have the capacity to take more bodies?
Well, because of the pandemic and because of changes in the way people are working, We have seen a reduction overall in the amount of ridership on transit systems around the country. And as a result, actually, transit systems have a lot of space for more riders. They will be able to absorb the increase in passengers from making buses and potentially trains free. But if the numbers went up dramatically, then yes, we would absolutely need more investment in improving public transportation services.
I mean, as you're hinting at here, one of the criticisms is that public transit has been underfunded for a very long time, and now you're taking another revenue stream out of public transit. Does that make these systems more sustainable in the long run, though?
From a financial perspective, we have a problem in the United States that we have not provided sustainable funding for public transportation perhaps ever in the history of this country. You know, if you look at countries in Europe and Asia, you see a lot more commitment to making sure that everyone has access to good bus and rail service pretty much anywhere where they live. And that's just not the case in the United States, because we haven't spent the money at the federal, state, or local levels. If we get rid of fare revenue, it's true that we might actually have an even bigger financial problem. But most of the cities that have talked about making buses or trains free have backed it up with some other new revenue source. So for the meantime, I don't think we are going to expect a significant drop in the revenues for transit systems.
All right, Yonah Freemark of the Urban Institute, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This week, the U.S. hit its credit limit, with lawmakers still divided over the nation's spending. And President Biden has been waving off hand-wringing over misplaced classified documents. That brings us to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post, with a welcome to you both. So just yesterday, the U.S. hit its debt ceiling. The Treasury Department says it's going to take extraordinary measures to keep the U.S. government paying its bills. David, this could be the riskiest showdown yet, given that House Speaker Kevin McCarthy offered those guarantees to those Republican hardliners in exchange for their votes to make him House Speaker, that there would be no raising of the debt ceiling without significant spending cuts.
Yeah, no, it makes me nostalgic for the debt ceiling crisis of 2011. It seemed sort of more or less like normal people were in control. And now you've got people off on Planet Debbie who have the speaker in their hands. And so I do think it is a pretty serious crisis. And so how do the Democrats react? Well, there are some people who say they should take unilateral action. There are some very unusual ways that Democrats could act alone. The 14th Amendment says the government has to pay off its debt, and they could say invoke the 14th Amendment and hope the Supreme Court backs you up. My favorite one, print a $1 trillion platinum coin. Apparently, somehow that's legal. But I think the most likely is to go to the Senate, try to build a bipartisan coalition, 60 votes, with a plan, and then throw it on the House and hope you can take some of the maybe the 18 House Republicans who were in Biden districts, districts Biden won. Hopefully, public opinion by that point will be so much against going off the cliff that some of them will break, and then they could work with the Democrats and get it passed. But that's a very tough road to hoe, actually.
Jonathan, what do you make of that strategy? The White House says they're not budging. I spoke to one White House official who said the debt limit was raised without strings attached a number of times in recent years when President Trump was in the White House and Republicans controlled Congress.
Right. And I think the White House is absolutely right to say emphatically and repeatedly, we are not negotiating over the debt ceiling. And people, every time we have this conversation, I am going to remind people that the debt ceiling is not about new spending. It is about spending that has already happened. We've bought the car, we bought the ring, we took the vacation, we ate and had digested the meal. We put it on a credit card. We have to pay the bill. And so the conversation about raising the debt limit and the conversation about spending cuts and getting our fiscal house in order, which always seems to come up when a Democrat's in the White House, is always forgotten when a Republican is in the White House, those should be two separate conversations. Once they raise the debt ceiling, then I think, everybody get together and let's have a serious conversation about how to get the nation's spending under control. But let's say they zero out the budget, cut everything next year. The bills for the car and the ring and the meal will still be showing up. And so that's why the two must be separate.
And David, to your point about hearkening back to the halcyon days of 2011, I mean, what makes this moment different is that it can't be assumed that every Republican isn't trying to avoid a fiscal Armageddon. I mean, how do you see this resolving within the conference, the Republican
conference? Yeah, that's right. Well, I think two things. I think if the Democrats are right for right now to say we need a clean bill, we're not going to. I think they should have in their back pocket a plan to, in case craziness happens, that offers the Republicans something so they can get 60 votes. The problem with the Republicans, and especially the more hardcore ones, is that they're doing what they always do. They're going into a battle for no plan on how to get out of it. And I don't think they even know what they're asking for in exchange. And so there's all sorts of dissension over that. And there are some, there's just this nihilistic wing who think that stopping the system is what they're here to do. And stopping the system is not exactly governance. And you just got to deal with the fact that they've got leverage right now. Yeah. And so that's why I think the Democrats should have a back pocket plan.
Is there a political benefit here for Democrats as you see it?
I mean, it sort of pains me to discuss this through a political lens. But welcome to Washington. Yeah, there is a political benefit because the Republicans will look even crazier as we go down this road. They are more unreasonable by the day. And then we start watching the markets react to the craziness. In 2011, we watched the nation's credit rating get downgraded by one of the rating agencies for the first time in our history. The markets are used to this, and they might start reacting long before potentially June and start issuing warnings. If you don't take action, here's what we're going to do. And the cost to the American people might not be seen immediately, but it will be felt down the road.
Well, as we mentioned earlier in the program, anti-abortion advocates from across the country gathered in Washington today for the annual March for Life, the first time since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. David, abortion opponents have really met their primary goal of gutting Roe. And right now, at least half of all states have banned or restricted access to abortion in most cases. Where does the movement go from here?
Well, so far it gets decentralized. And so they used to have these big national organizations. They'd do this march, they'd end up at the Supreme Court, and they had a clear focus, which was to end Roe. But now it's state by state. And what you're seeing is a lot of the national organizations are being sidelined by state organizations, and the action is in the state legislatures. And there's wide difference in what the activities should be. A lot of the Catholic groups, for example, they want to put the emphasis on the pregnancy crisis centers to help women through this process and support them in the way they need to be supported them. Others just want to, you know, work on the law and get to a zero abortion set of laws on the state level. What I'm curious about is how this evolves, because public opinion is shifting, and you see national Republicans walking away from hardcore pro-life positions because it's so unpopular. And the big question for me is, right now, it looks like you have some states where it'll be a complete abortion freedom and some states with none. And will popular opinion ever evolve to the point where it's 20 weeks or 15 weeks or whatever some midpoint will be? That's where a lot of the country is, but it's not where the state laws are.
And Jonathan, as it moves state by state, it is still a key issue in state legislative elections. There was just a special election in Virginia that in many ways was a proxy vote about abortion access, and a Democrat won that race.
Yeah. We were having this discussion before the midterm elections about what kind of impact would the Dobbs decision have on the election. Now we know. And now, thanks to Justice Clarence Thomas and his concurring opinion, he made it clear that it wasn't just Roe v. Wade. We should also look at Griswold, which had to do with contraception. And I think while the movement may decentralize to the states, you know, we still have Senator Lindsey Graham, who in the last Congress introduced a national abortion ban. That's something that I think will be of great interest to the movement. But also, you know, who's to say that contraception, someone might not introduce a national contraception ban. I mean, we're in crazy times, and we have to keep our imagination open. But just because the movement has won on Roe v. Wade doesn't mean that the movement will stop at the national level, I don't think.
Well, this time last week, we were talking about President Biden's handling of those classified documents and how the White House was handling that whole issue. Well, just yesterday, the president spoke on the record about it. And as he fielded the question, he first chided reporters, suggesting that there were more important things to talk about. And then he said this.
We found a handful of documents were filed in the wrong place. We immediately turned them over to the archives of the Justice Department. We're fully cooperating, looking forward to getting this resolved quickly. I think you're going to find there's nothing there. I have no regrets. I'm following what the lawyers have told me they want me to do. It's exactly what we're doing. There's no there there.
So the substance of the case is what it is, but on the messaging, it appears that the White House has settled on something of a mitigation strategy. He's out here talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to have to talk about it. you know, I think he's, it's with the proviso that it's not like Trump. I'm not going to make this any comparisons. I think the story's a little worse for the White House this week than it was last week, and that's for a couple of reasons. One, we've learned, thanks to reporting in my newspaper, that they were hoping to deep six it so it would never come out. Mm. And so they didn't report it for all those times because they thought they could make the Justice Department happy and it would never see light of day. That just doesn't happen often in Washington. And so I think the effort to try to deep six it was not the right thing to do, and I think it's backfiring on them. And then we've learned that the story of revealing everything has been mostly right, but there have been hiccups. They said we completed our search, then they find new documents later, so it gets a little messier. I still think it's a medium to medium small size issue, but I think the administration, as a general rule, has a tendency to hoard information. And this is maybe a warning shot that they should rethink some of those habits.
And what's your take?
And thanks to the great reporting in my newspaper on the front page yesterday. I mean, I disagreed that the White House was trying to deep six. According to our reporting yesterday, it was they were taking the lead and giving deference to the Justice Department, which was already investigating. What we have here, I think, is a political PR response versus the legal response. And we've seen in all sorts of instances where those two interests are completely different and they are in conflict, and we're seeing it in high relief in this case.
Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, it's always a pleasure to speak with you both.
Great to see you, Jeff.
And that is the News Hour for tonight. Remember, there is much more online, including a look at a law that is meant to make medical billing more transparent. And be sure to join Yamiche Alcindor and her panel on Washington Week later tonight, right here on PBS. And of course, watch PBS News Weekend tomorrow for a look at the anti-government protests in Peru that are becoming increasingly deadly. I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us, and have a great weekend.